When the Upstate Drone Coalition, Drone Action Coalition, decided to organize a Convergence for Action, we did a conference with workshops and a demonstration at Hancock back in the last weekend of April in Syracuse. When we brought that together, we quickly came to the conclusion that our opposition to drone warfare needed to be set into context. So we called that conference the Resisting Global Wars, Empire, and Drones. And I'm using that for the title of my talk tonight for the obvious reasons that we do need to set things in context. Now, I think what we need to do is tell the truth as far as we know it, and that is essential. Our war-making capabilities and behaviors must always be subject to judgment, our judgment. Judgments based on fact, sensitivity, conscience, and when necessary, passion. We need to connect the dots. We need to connect the issues, and we need to connect with people. In an era when people who take it upon themselves to inform us, like Bradley Manning and Julian Assange and others, and they face interminable prison sentences because of it, sharing facts and analyses sometimes is perceived by the authorities as being subversive activity. In a time when great fear of terrorists is constantly being encouraged by our mass media and by government policies, we need to not rush to judgment on whom they deem to be our enemies. And we must refuse to hide out in silence. We need to speak up. When our government conducts wars of aggression for resources, for the comfort of fewer and fewer people, international law and all the best spiritual traditions say that we must do what we can to stop the killing. Last week, the Congressional Progressive Caucus held a hearing about the legal basis for the drone program. Congresswoman Barbara Lee and several others had sent a letter to the White House back in March, which went unanswered. They questioned the drone program's unlimited geographic scope, unnamed officials in charge of a hit list, vagueness in defining whether captures are feasible, overly broad definition of imminent threat, and the invocation of the authorization for the use of military force that was passed right after 9/11. This was, of course, a start in asking the right questions. On April 23rd, a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee held a similar hearing. Rosa Brooks, who is now a Georgetown law professor, who was the Pentagon Special Coordinator for the Rule of Law and Humanitarian Policy during Obama's first term, said this: "What it comes down to, Senator Durbin, is that right now we have an executive branch making a claim that it has the right to kill anyone, anywhere on earth, at any time, for secret reasons based on secret evidence in a secret process undertaken by unidentified officials. That frightens me. I don't doubt their good faith, but it's not the rule of law as we know it." She wants to see the memos justifying the program. And of course, seeing those memos would be a good start. But again, it's a start. We need to go further. She was followed by Faria al-Muslimi, a youth activist from Yemen whose village had been hit by a drone strike 6 days before, on April 17th, just last month. You can hear his testimony on the web on Democracy Now!'s program of April 24th. He spoke of his love of America based on his living here for a year as a high school student and his relationship with his host, coming to America as an ambassador for Yemen and going back to Yemen as an ambassador for the U.S. The U.S. was intending to kill Hamid al-Rodney, who could easily have been captured because he was so well known. The village of Wasab was hit, and now there is intense anger against America in Wasab. He went on, "This is not an isolated incident. The drone strikes are the face of America to many Yemenis. I have spoken to many victims of U.S. drone strikes, one a mother in Jar who had to identify her innocent 18-year-old son's body through a video on a stranger's cell phone, or the father in Shakra who held his 4 and 6-year-old children as they died in his arms." Al-Muslami tells of hearing a drone over a village in Abyan province and wondering with total helplessness whether the drone pilot was his friend back in the States. He deeply believes that, quote, "when Americans truly know how much pain and suffering the U.S. airstrikes have caused and how much they are harming efforts to win hearts, minds, and grounds in Yemen, they will reject this devastating targeted killing program," unquote. On April 18th, last month, I was one of 5 who went to trial on the violation level of trespass for one of several earlier protests of drone warfare at Hancock Base in Syracuse. When it came my turn to speak to the judge in defense, I told the story of Tariq Aziz. In October 2011, there was a Waziristan Grand Jirga in Islamabad, a meeting of over 60 Pakistani elders and some Westerners. A jirga is a council of elders that in the villages serves as a combination court of law and parliament. These elders told of the continued overflights of drones and the deaths and terror in their area. They found that they needed proof to present to the outside world. Nobody believed them. Foreign journalists are not allowed in the federally administered tribal areas. And the Taliban represses reporting as spying for Westerners. So this young 16-year-old by the name of Tariq Aziz was present and volunteered to undertake this dangerous assignment. He learned to use video cameras and went back home with the encouragement, the mandate even, of his elders. 3 days later, while driving a car with his cousin to visit their aunt, they were hit with a Hellfire missile from an American drone. They were blown to pieces and had to be identified by body parts. So here we have this young man wanting to show the world the truth of what was happening to his people, getting the blessing and encouragement of his elders, then being killed by a drone strike that has only a fig leaf of a claim of legitimacy from the American White House. His assignment had what was to him the highest legitimacy, and he was stopped by a program that violates all concepts of law with only a flimsy and spurious claim of necessity. Law can be used for the highest of purposes, as in the jirga sending this young man to document reality. And law can be used for the basest of purposes, defending the fear-based assassinations of the innocent. The killing of the innocent must never be business as usual, the normal course of events, but should be seen for what it is, a catastrophe, an outrage, and an attack upon the good order of all that is good and holy. Law can be either one of the greatest achievements of humanity or the falsification of morality. It can serve the purposes of life or it can serve the purposes of death. We have been given the gift of international law under the Nuremberg Conventions and the Geneva Conventions. which mandate the stopping of war crimes. And we have been given the gift of the First Amendment, which, within common sense guidelines, absolutely protects free speech, particularly when that speech is unpopular, as ours has been. So now we have the gift and the opportunity to take a step towards stopping the killing. We can say, yes, we have been a violent people, but not today. We can choose to take responsibility for our actions as a people, or not. It's up to us. I said to the judge in conclusion that we have no need to work at cross purposes here. Law is a wonderful instrument when it safeguards and promotes human life, and it should be used for that purpose. The only question that Judge Jokel had about that was common sense guidelines to free speech, and I said, well, we're not supposed to shout fire in a crowded theater because we don't want to create panic. And our action was designed not to cause panic, but to promote dialogue. We stood in the driveway holding signs. Yes, we were interrupting business as usual, but for the sake of dialogue. Judge Jokel then found all of us guilty of trespass and several days later sentenced us to 15 days in jail, and we served that from April 24th to May 3rd. It's only 10 days because they automatically deduct a third of it for good behavior unless you violate things while you're in jail, which we were not about to do on such a short sentence. If you want to hear more about these stories of innocents being killed, read the Stanford NYU report called Living Under Drones. It is an excellent documentary. And you could also read Medea Benjamin's book, Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. You can also watch the videos of the conference workshops on our upstatedroneaction.org website and on YouTube. The hits of people being killed in the Middle East include wedding parties, a village jirga, and young boys tending sheep. There is also the procedure the pilots call double tap, the firing of another missile at the bombing site when rescuers and other bystanders have congregated. I first learned of this disgusting practice in Iraq when Kathy Kelly took us to the Amariah shelter, a civilian bomb shelter in a residential neighborhood of Baghdad, which during the Gulf War was first hit by a bomb launched by an F-15 through the ventilation shaft, and then hit again with an incendiary down through the same hole, killing 476 innocent people. Men, women, and children. It is a standard U.S. practice, and Iraqis, Afghanis, and Pakistanis know it. Modern drone warfare started in Abraham Karam's garage in California, where he dreamed up and built with seed money from DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the first prototype of what became the Predator. Today, the Predator is made by General Atomics, which is now a multi-million dollar company because of its contracts with the Pentagon. Airborne hunter-killer robots piloted by our sons and daughters and brothers and sisters, they sit at Creech and Hancock and other places. These airborne killers are, in the words of Leon Panetta, who was at the time the head of the CIA, he called them the only game in town. There are now Reapers and Predators from General Atomics, mini drones from air environments such as the Hummingbird, the Raven, the Wasp, the Puma, and the Switchblade. Raytheon has its Cobra, Boeing has its Phantom Ray, and Grumman has its Global Hawk. Lockheed Martin makes the Hellfire missiles. And it makes the Romeo Hellfire, which is a Hellfire missile with more computer stuff on it and fancier avionics. Lockheed Martin at its Skunk Works in Palmdale, California, makes the RQ-170 Sentinel, which is known as the Beast of Kandahar. Israel the United Kingdom, South Africa, have made drones. They have produced drones. China also. The last I heard, 50 countries have drones. Over 500 American companies want in on the contracts. And the new bull market for drones is police departments all across America, further blurring the line between military and police, a line that should not be blurred, but it's happening. It's a jobs program. Kathy Kelly tells us the Air Force uses about 70,000 analysts poring over footage from drones to understand patterns of life over Afghanistan. And the Air Force wants 100,000. They've got so much footage. The whole system is worldwide and employs a lot of people. And it's satellite-based. It's total dominance. It's, you know, in the sky, in outer space, too. Kathy Kelly says that if you want to learn patterns of life, you should learn to live with the people, not shoot missiles at them. So what's wrong with having our sons and daughters fighting a war from home without putting themselves physically in harm's way? It is politically enormously popular to point to the safety of firing missiles from a trailer parked at Creech or at Hancock and other places. Sitting dressed in flight suits in front of computer screens, computer terminals and video screens, while thousands of miles from the battlefield. The Air Force thinks that so far the only problem is stress from overwork while more pilots are trained. But think of the scenario. The battlefield is at once 8,000 miles away and 18 inches away. The drones hover over their targets, sometimes for days at a time. The operators watch the normal activities of people, getting to know them, while at the same time hyped up by the desire to be in real combat and get in some real kills. Bug splat, as they call them. And they watch the squirters flee from the burning vehicles or buildings, the people running from the fire outside of where they were sitting. And then these pilots go home to Camillus, New York, or Las Vegas, Nevada, or wherever, to watch television with their kids. This exercise in moral whiplash can lead to stress and sometimes post-traumatic stress disorder, as some have been diagnosed. Our legislators, particularly Chuck Schumer, pushed this as job creation in upstate New York. Some job. In fact, Schumer pushed for Hancock as one of six national sites for coordination. He used the same rationale last week to call for a ballistic missile site at Fort Drum. And he boasted about it in his emails. This is Ronald Reagan's Star Wars. Still around. Meanwhile, those whose relatives have been killed in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and elsewhere can reasonably be expected to want to retaliate. Why wouldn't they? Which someday they may accomplish. And then upstate New York will be a war zone. On April 22nd, 2011, 38 of us were arrested for doing a die-in in the driveway at Hancock. At our trial for disorderly conduct, in our defense, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, remember from the Lyndon Johnson administration, Ramsey Clark testified as an expert witness in international law that drone warfare is illegal, and that all of us, citizens and officials alike, are mandated to stop our government from committing war crimes, especially aggressive war. Now, of course, the problem is that the Nuremberg judgments and the Geneva Conventions do not contain enforcement mechanisms built into them. So we are trying to challenge any government official we can to follow the intent of these laws anyway. In our actions at the base, we have continually tried to deliver an indictment for war crimes to base officials and to anyone in there. Our serious legal attempt is refused, and in response, many of us have individually been issued orders of protection by the DeWitt Town Court, ordering us not to in any way try to communicate with the base commander. This misuse of a statute that is designed for domestic violence is being challenged within the judicial system of Onondaga County as an overreach of authority and as a violation of the First Amendment rights of free speech and petitioning for the redress of grievances. Twice a month, some of us gather across the street from the base entrance to hold signs in a vigil for which we have an ongoing permit. We've had people do direct action there, risking and undergoing arrests over half a dozen times, including having 31 people arrested there on April 28th, just a couple of weeks ago. Four of us were not there on that occasion because Judge Jokel had put us in lockup. Oh, well. Was it a coincidence? I'm not sure. I don't know. I can't read his mind. One thing that has happened, which is very encouraging to me, is subtle but very significant. We don't explain this in terms of civil disobedience. We don't say that's what we're doing. We say we're doing civil resistance. And we say that we have the legal, repeat, legal right and duty to do these things. I go into court these days feeling far less defensive. And we hope that one day, eventually, a judge will rule in our favor on that basis. More and more people across the country and elsewhere are starting to educate, agitate, and organize. Nick Mottern runs a website called nodrones.com and has helped build model drones to use in street theater and education. The Syracuse Peace Council has done a tableau dramatizing the process of death dealing across the street from the New York State Fair. The Creech 14, including our own George and Judy Hamanich, trespassed at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada in 2009, and the Nevada Desert Experience continues this. Mary Snyder, a retired nurse from Johnson City, is a repeat offender at Hancock. So is the intrepid veteran peacenik Jack Gilroy, who has written a two-act play called The Predator, which we should produce sometime. And it should be produced in colleges and universities and high schools, wherever we can. Maybe we can have a presentation of that in one of our meetings soon. Jack is also continuing his campaign to try to get Catholic Bishop Robert Cunningham of Syracuse to come out and speak about the drones. Kathy Kelly, for Voices in the Wilderness and now Voices for Creative Nonviolence, continues to take people to visit war zones, such as last October in Pakistan, and she speaks eloquently of those she meets, as does Medea Benjamin. Colonel Anne Wright continually challenges people from her background as an Army officer and then as a State Department diplomat who resigned over the invasion of Iraq. There are coalitions of groups forming. Our upstate coalition to ground the drones and end the wars has people from Buffalo, Rochester, Ithaca, Binghamton, Syracuse, Albany, some from downstate, and some from New England. The raging grannies sing songs and risk arrest. Peace Action of New York State and many of its chapters, including this one, and Peace Action National have been strong supporters. Since there is talk of a remote split operations squadron, that's a military term, at the Niagara Falls Air Reserve Station, meaning another drone base for the U.S. Air Force, Buffalo area people are now demonstrating there, including 2 days ago on Mother's Day. Charlie Bowman is pushing for a solar farm there instead. That would be a good idea. You can go to the nodronesnetwork.blogspot.com to see activities nationwide, including the newly formed network to stop drone surveillance and warfare. This is all quite open activity, which needs many more people to help in whatever way one feels called to do. Take the next step. Think about it. One doesn't have to risk jail, but one can do other things. And maybe think about risking arrest. But there's always more to do. The U.S. is no longer engaged in discrete wars with beginnings and ends and laudable objectives. The oil pipelines in Southwest Asia are considered vital strategic interests by our government, as is, of course, the Persian Gulf. The mineral wealth of Afghanistan is almost incalculable, including copper, iron, high-grade chrome ore, uranium, beryl, barite, lead, zinc, feldspar, bauxite, lithium for batteries, tantalum, emeralds, gold and silver, some oil, and a large deposit of natural gas. Plus, Afghanistan is a crossing point for the TAPI, the oil pipeline. That stands for Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India oil pipeline. There are other pipelines in the area. So let's be honest about our motives being heavily and even unbearably influenced by the needs of America's corporate empire. Raw materials, cheap labor, and markets continue to drive our politics and our military needs. War may be destabilizing for profits, except for the war makers, for the weapons makers, I should say, but access to resources and control of markets is defined as in the national interest. Woodrow Wilson's idealism, which was a thin and naive cover for empire building, has given way to Henry Kissinger's real politic and projection of lethal force. Under the military rubric of full spectrum dominance through a full range of technologies, we have a continual, even desperate projection of hubris and its delusions, and what looks like a total incomprehension of what we are doing to other peoples and to ourselves. We're not the shining city on the hill anymore, if we ever were. So let's forget the idea of American exceptionalism. We have to ask ourselves if it is true whether, as Martin Luther King said in regards to the war in Vietnam, which he was so roundly condemning, "My country is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today," quote unquote. We are addicted to violence and our lifestyle of consumption of the Earth's resources, and we need to admit it and start some variation of the 12-step program, some sort of political 12-step program to overcome these addictions. Another context of drone warfare is that it is part, of course, it's the rest of the scandal of the past several years. The scandal of Guantanamo and other prisons such as Abu Ghraib and the use of torture since 9/11. And I would include the force feeding of hunger striking Guantanamo prisoners as a form of torture, an ongoing one. Most of them have been cleared as innocent but have been held for as much as 12 years without judicial proceedings. Americans may forget, but people in the region have not. Question: how many middle-of-the-night house break-ins have our troops done in the Middle East since 2001? I don't know the answer to that. I just throw it out there. It's not hard to imagine retaliation against us as being by them seen as defensive in nature. We are better than this. We believe in the rule of law. And we must make the government follow the law. Because I missed the conference, being in lockup, I missed a lot of good talks. I did listen to excerpts from the opening panel on my computer on YouTube. I heard David Swanson say that we shouldn't hesitate to use the word murder. I heard Kathy Kelly say that we need to overcome the culture of fear that has dominated us, both in terms of fear of terrorists and the fear of losing our jobs. She also said that where you stand influences what you see, meaning that she lives literally with people under the gun and comes back to tell us about it. And I heard Bruce Gagnon come out with an interesting theory, a projection really, that our U.S. economy is increasingly based on providing security for the rest of the world with weapons and surveillance, information and bullets. And that's how we, as a U.S. work, as the U.S. workforce, will more and more support ourselves. Is that where we're going? I have a different vision of how to relate to the rest of the world. I don't think we should hide behind our technology when dealing with other peoples. I don't think we should keep this sense of entitlement to the world's resources. Mother Earth can't sustain our style of life anyway. And we can ill afford to keep a neo-colonialist attitude of superiority to our fellow human beings. I don't think that dehumanizing of those deemed enemies by our authorities is right and just. And the psychic numbing that we experience from living in the empire is a symbol of a deep moral sickness that we are in dire need of healing. Martin Luther King also said that it is no longer a choice between violence and nonviolence, between nonviolence and non-existence. Nonviolence is not just an attitude, but it is also a way of responding to the powers that be that places them under judgment, our judgment, and eventual transformation. The latest Plowshares actors used that concept for their action, transform now. I would submit, based upon the experiences of many of my friends and myself, that nonviolence is first of all, an option, then a choice, then a habit, then a discipline. And when it finally gets into your bones and straightens your spine and opens your lungs and your mouth and your brain and your spirit, you realize that nonviolent is the way we human beings were meant to be. We can all do at least a little more because so much needs to be done. When Judge Gideon asked Ramsey Clark in the Hancock 38 trial what he, the judge, should do, given that domestic law largely ignores international law, Ramsey said, "Do what is best for the children."